So I'm going to talk today about heavy element synthesis and how that relates, of course, to neutron-star mergers and the production of our process. A lot of this work has been done in collaboration with particularly my students and postdocs. But most of the sort of seminal work was actually led by Luke Roberts, who's now a professor at MSU, but he was a grad student at UC Santa Cruz. So let me give you a little bit of an outline of what I want to do, and hopefully it'll be pedagogical, so please stop me if it's not. So I want to give you a review of, you know, what is important in terms of talking about nuclear properties and R process nucleosynthesis. So I'll basically explain you what the R process is. Then I'll tell you what we know from the abundance patterns of stars, which in some ways guides the model making. Then I'll tell you neutron star mergers as a site of R process nucleosynthesis, so how effective they are. And I'll focus on how is the R process made, particularly in the tidal tails, which are relatively easy to understand, when it was actually ejected into the interstellar medium to basically mix with other elements, and where in galaxies it takes place. We now know, and I'll review the clues from the gravitational wave detector. We're fairly confident that neutron star mergers are very effective R process factories in the local universe. But then I'll tell you a little bit more about what can we learn from chemical evolution and whether or not our, you know, our process material could have been effectively synthesized by these events over the course of the history of the universe. And there's some sort of very interesting observation signatures that we can talk about as we go through. So for astronomers, of course, this is our periodic table. This is, you know, a high resolution spectrum of the sun. So what we do is basically we take these features and we transform them into an abundance pattern distribution, which is done here. And if you just solely looked at this solar abundance pattern, there's lots and lots of things that you can learn. So if you focus on the mass number, you clearly see that the abundance pattern correlates with these magic numbers, which is the number of closed neutron and proton shells. You can clearly see that elements all the way to iron have equal numbers of neutrons and protons. And in these magic numbers, which basically are the most stable nuclei, the abundance pattern is actually drastically increased. And we'll talk about why that's the case. Another thing that you can see is, of course, the odd and uneven variations. And I'll tell you a little bit about where these patterns emerge. So for example, you can be doubly magic, which means, you know, both neutrons and protons are in closed shells. You can be singly magical. Another thing that it's very striking here is that as you increase in mass number, the stable nuclei have a significantly larger number of neutrons. So this is, for example, singly magical. And there's, you know, you have to wait all the way to lead, which is doubly magical, but you immediately see the discrepancy between the number of neutrons and the number of protons. So something that I'm going to talk to you a little bit about is, for example, these peaks. Naively, they appear not to correlate with nuclear stability, and those are the R process peaks. And what I will show you is that, in fact, they are related to nuclear stability, but they were produced very far from stability. So what we've seen is basically the decay. So I'll guide you through those arguments. And of course, that tells you the abundance pattern, and of course, the abundance normalizations have to do with nucleosynthesis in the universe, and as we know, Big Bang nucleosynthesis produced the majority of the mass, the baryonic mass in the universe, and then nuclear burning basically is responsible for producing elements all the way to iron. So the question here that we're going to talk about is, well, how can you make nuclei that are heavier than iron? So one of the first impediments that you have is, as you know, iron is the most bound nuclei in the universe. So that means that any reaction that leads to higher Z elements, it's basically an endothermic reaction. That means that you have to give energy to the system. That's the first impediment. As you know, nuclear fusion, it's an exothermic reaction. So basically it gives energy to the stars, and that keeps stars fighting their life against gravity. But the largest impediment is, in fact, that with atomic number, the Coulomb barrier increases, and at stellar temperatures, basically, charge reactions are impossible to make these nuclei. So you have to rely on neutron capture. So almost exclusively, all elements above iron have been made by capturing neutrons. Now, astronomers were not very inventive, and we have what we call the S process and the R process. And S stands for slow, R stands for rapid. And what happens is when you capture a neutron, you beta decay. You're unstable radioactively, you beta decay. Yeah? If the time scale for decay is fast compared to the time scale of capturing neutrons, we call that the slow process, which means that that process, as I will show you, happens very close to the beta stability line. Now, for the R process, what has to happen is you have to capture neutrons much faster than the beta decay. Yeah? About half of the elements are produced by the S process, and half of the elements are produced by the R process. And what I'm going to focus about is on the R process. And here, if you actually looked at the abundance patterns, what you see, as I was arguing before, you have a first, second, and third peak. That's what we call the first, second, and third peak, and they're related to the neutron closed shell stability. And in our process, we have first, second, and third peak, but they seem shift to the left. So I'm going to take a little bit of time and give you a feeling as to why this pattern emerges and where in the nuclear physics you get this. And in order to do this, we're going to spend a little bit of time studying this sort of classical plot in which we shown the proton number on this axis, the neutron number. The first thing that you see in black are the stable nuclei. So if you are basically growing in the S process, what you do is you capture a neutron and you beta decay. So if the beta decay time scale is very short, then you basically are moving very close to what we call this beta of stability. Okay? Something that you should immediately notice, this is the time scale for beta decay. So imagine that I'm here, somewhere in a stable nuclei, and I start moving farther and farther away from stability. These nuclei, of course, have a half-life time that is progressively shorter and shorter. Yeah? So as you move far from stability, the time scales are short. That means if you want to make something like the R process, as I will tell you, you have to do it relatively quickly. Just to illustrate, this is a sort of energy separation of about 2 mega electron volts. This basically shows you what the isotopes are that are stable as you go through an R process pathway. And if you immediately see the time scales, you are in the sort of hundreds of milliseconds time scales in which you have to capture these neutrons. So just simply by those argument, you know, if you think about, well, what compact object in the universe has a time scale that are about 100 milliseconds or shorter, it's a neutron star. Yeah? So that led people to think, well, there's only two environments in which you can do this. One is in a supernova when the neutron star is born, in the proto-neutron star case, or in a neutron star merger. And those solely the time scales, and also, of course, the time scales are also determined by the density of the neutrons, and you need very high density. So that immediately points out to those environments as being the only. Okay, so here we have the magic numbers, the closed neutron shells. Remember, those are shells in which these nuclei are stable. So if you're stable, you don't want to capture neutrons. You don't want to be, you know, left out or taken away from stability. So these are the magic numbers, and usually we're referred to as the first peak, second peak, and third peak. Now, let me try to give you a feeling of what happened to the capture cross-section around these closed neutron shells. And you know, in order to do this, I just use a standard textbook which shows the neutron capture cross-sections of nuclei in the S process. And the neutron energy here is about 25 kiloelectron volts. But something that it's actually, so the first thing that you notice is that odd mass numbers tend to have higher cross-sections than even nuclei. And if you remember about the abundance pattern, those fluctuations that you see between odd and even come directly from stability of the nuclei. So that's the first thing that we notice. The other thing that is just striking is the substantial lowering of the cross sections near the magic number. Why is that the case? Because of course, if I'm close to stability, I don't want to capture neutrons. And not surprising, abundance anti-correlates with neutron capture cross-section. So the way that I visualize, at least to give me some intuition, is you can imagine that you have a neutron flow. And then if the neutron flow arrives to one of these neutron closed shells, it basically stops. And then what you get is stagnation of neutrons at that particular position. Well, it's sort of like you're going on a highway, you have an accident, all of these neutrons start piling up at that particular position because they're basically not able to cross at a similar rate, you know, rate across that boundary, and then the abundance pattern at that particular point basically increases. Okay, so that is very, very important that you know, these stagnation points of neutron capture is what leads to these high abundance peaks. So for example, let's do it for the S process. So if I'm basically capturing neutrons and I'm moving very close to the beta valley stability, once I get to this neutron number, I start basically stagnating here and I get my first peak, I move, I get my second peak, I move and I get my third peak, okay? Now, if I do this in the R process, which is extremely far away from stability, as illustrated here, I go in and basically I'm capturing a neutron and beta decay. Here, actually, it's very, very difficult to cross that boundary, and therefore I lead to a stagnation, and therefore there's gonna be an abundance peak here. I move, there's another abundance peak. I move, and there's another abundance peak. But what happens? These abundance peaks are unstable, and they beta decay. So what you're looking at when you look at the abundance pattern is the projection of this in the beta decay scale. So of course I have first peak of our process, which is basically shifted to the left compared to the S process peak. Second peak shifted to the left. Third peak shifted to the left. So naively, of course, once you see instability, these peaks do not correspond to neutron closed shells, but they did before all of those neutrons became protons. And the only thing that is happening is that you're doing this capture far away from stability. And that's basically,
I have a question.
Yeah.
About the slope of these lines. If the R, and I'm a little bit outside of this field, but if the R process is one where the rate of acquiring neutrons dwarfs the rate of converting them to protons through beta decay, shouldn't you expect the R process line to have a different slope on these axes than the S process? Why do they seem like they have such parallel slopes?
So the slope here is actually given by what is the most likely isotope that I'm go through when I do the neutron capture beta decay, yeah? And then of course there's an ocean of isotopes that could that you can land on, and that ultimately determines the slope. If that makes sense. So the pattern is not for, you know, it's not solely depending on this ratio, but it depends on the nuclear structure of the particular isotopes along this line of sight. And in fact, but you can clearly see when you look at the beta stability time scales that this pattern doesn't deviate very much from the, say, blue and orange. And that will tell you that basically you're basically constrained to the stability of the nuclei across that line. But it's not necessarily that all lines have to be have this slope given by the neutron scale. So the slope here is given by the exact nuclear structure of the nuclei. And in fact, you can even think that, you know, what gives this slope for the stable nuclei? Well, it's basically the structure. And as you know, you can do the spherical nuclei very effectively for the first peak, but once you go second and third peak, the shells are no longer spherical and you deviate from equilibrium, and in some ways that is related to the question that you're asking as to what gives this slope, which is the structure of the nuclei as a function of atomic number. Okay, so when people talk about a particular element being produced by one or the other process, you know, both processes produce elements. About half of the mass is given by the S process, half of the mass is given by the R process. I'm highlighting europium here because europium is what we use to trace R process contents in stars. Why? As I will show you, the europium atomic line has a very high oscillation strength, and therefore it leaves an imprint in the spectrum that is actually very deep. So we use europium, basically, which lives in this peak. Now, if you're interested, I can tell you why there's a peak or why we don't understand that there's a peak between the second and third peak. But this air rare peak is actually highly debated, the origin of it. You can go to sort of my favorite element, which is almost 99% our process, which is gold and platinum. So when you hear about gold production in the universe, we relate that to this peak, which is almost solely given by the R process. But if you look at lead, lead, you know, can be 70, 30% in terms of their R process and S process contribution. Okay, so what do we know about R process in the universe in general, which we'll get from doing high resolution spectroscopic observations of the halo stars in the Milky Way. You can think of those stars, these are the fossil record of chemical evolution. And basically by looking at the spectrum, we can think about how the abundance pattern actually has evolved. Here I show, I think anyone that works in the R process has his favorite star, which is what is called the Sneden star. Chris Sneden discovered it. And I'll show you why this star is so interesting. And of course here it doesn't look very interesting. So this star, it's basically the highest relative content of gold of any stars in the universe. So its europium content is very, very high. The first thing that I wanted just to highlight is this is a compilation of a broad range of stars, very low metallicity stars. So that means stars that were born very early in the universe. Remember, the Big Bang produced primarily hydrogen and helium. Astronomers call anything that is not hydrogen and helium a metal. So when we say low metallicity, it means that, and particularly we use iron as a tracer of metallicity. But something that you see here, they have been artificially shifted. So this doesn't tell you anything about the total mass content, but it tells you about the relative abundance. And this is the R process relative abundance of the sun, and these are basically of low metallicity stars. And the match is kind of astounding. So what this tells you is that whatever is producing the R process has to produce an abundance pattern that is extremely robust. Yeah, that means that it shouldn't really depend very strongly on the initial conditions and that you should converge to that abundance pattern. And what it's usually well covered by the observations is basically the abundance pattern between the second and the third peak. Yeah? So what we know is that the abundance pattern of the R process between the second and third peak is extremely robust, has been operated since almost the beginning of the universe, and it's been operating in a way that is extremely robust all the way to the formation of the sun and beyond. Okay? So whatever mechanisms that you have to come up has to give you that robustness.
The second and the third peak there are which, can you just point to which you mean by the second peak? So
the second is here and the third one.
Sorry. The second one is that one.
So this pattern is being set, you're saying, by the rate at which neutrons are being captured by the nuclei?
Yeah, it's a little bit more complex. I'll show you the nuclear networks that we use and how this pattern is.
Right. But if that rate, I mean, changes from object to object, then this pattern should also be different from object to object.
Yeah, or if, for example, if the initial entropy of the material changes the capture rate, then you'll...
Over time, even for some explosion, like that rate will change, right? But yet you're saying that this pattern is very stable from object to object.
Well, what I'm saying is whatever happens in the central source, and I will show you a calculation of how we visualize that, like a neutron star merger, that the initial conditions, remember, everything happens within a few dynamical timescales of the expansion, and then you basically freeze to some pattern. And that pattern has been basically whatever mechanisms you think, you know, astrophysically has to be extremely robust. So what we will argue is that, for example, if the initial conditions of the sources, even if they change slightly, you always have to converge to the same pattern. And that seems to be the case in most calculations when you're extremely neutron rich. The entropy doesn't seem to matter, and how neutron rich you are, it doesn't matter if you're below like 0.1. And I'll talk a little bit about that.
Maximum amount of neutron flux that these things can, maximum rate at which they can absorb them. So if the rate of neutrons being provided for them to absorb is higher than some threshold, it doesn't really matter how much higher than that threshold.
Yeah, and I think what matters a lot is in nuclear statistical equilibrium at T equals zero, what is the number of neutrons that you have, and what are the nuclei that you have. And what I will show you is that, in fact, when the material is extremely neutron-rich, in nuclear statistical equilibrium, you have both free neutrons, but you also have the heavy element nuclei already ready to be to capture neutrons. You'll see how the pattern evolves, and if you have more questions, we can talk about them. Okay, so for a long period of time, people thought, well, both core collapse supernovae, core collapse supernova gives you both the alpha elements and also our process elements. So magnesium here is an alpha element. The way that astronomers actually plot abundance patterns, they use this equation. So the ratio is basically in number of nuclei, the ratio of number of nuclei in log space, and we always normalize to the sun. So the sun leaves 0, 0. So the sun is somewhere here. So it has basically solar metallicity in every single element. And what you see here is that the magnesium content of stars at low metallicity, this is basically one part in 1,000 the iron content of the sun. The magnesium abundance was higher than the solar value and then slowly decrease. And the argument here is that you have core collapse and you're converging to the yield, and then type 1a supernova come in the universe, which produce more iron and reduce the alpha to iron content. But something that is striking is that the RMS fluctuations of stars at a given iron abundance are very, very large when you looked at europium compared to magnesium. And when people saw this, they say, well, it's not possible that the same source is producing these variations and these variations. So what people said is, well, in order to get these large RMS fluctuations, I need a source that is much less common than core collapse, so that the abundance fluctuations are larger. That means that the mixing in the gas is more inhomogeneous. And I'll give you some analogy when I show you sort of large-scale simulations of mixing of where this arrives. So that basically led people to start really putting into question that core collapse were an effective way of producing these elements. And still today, if you want to produce that with core collapse, you have to basically, and I'll make another argument, make a source that it's rare but produces more mass per event. Let me just illustrate how these, another interesting thing is that not every single low metallicity star has our process. Only a few percent of metal poor and old stars have our process signatures, at least to the limits of the signal to noise of the spectrum. But let me show you, for example, two stars, one that has relatively low europium, and this is, of course, the Sneden star, which has one of the highest relative europium fraction. So here, the gold content, even though they have the same iron, the gold content is almost a factor of 500. One has, you can think about almost two orders of magnitude, a little bit more than two orders of magnitude in difference in the R process, even though the iron abundance is very, very similar. And then spectrally, this is nicely illustrated. For example, if you look at calcium features. Yes. So this doesn't point that well, but can you? So this is the first features in the spectrum. These are calcium, and you can see both stars have similar calcium features. But if you look to europium, which is here, look at the difference in strength. So this star has tons and tons of europium versus this one that has much lower content of europium. And that's basically how we do the determination of the abundance patterns of the stars. So just looking at the observations, we suggest that the production of heavy R process elements first need to operate robustly and at a drastically reduced rate when compared to core collapse. Okay, so I'm going to make a very, very simple argument as to how much R process material you need to produce in a source. And this is solely empirical, and it's actually a very clean and beautiful argument that it's kind of surprising that hasn't been done before. So the argument is you have an explosion, either a supernova or a neutron star merger, that produces a significant amount of energy. You get a blast wave as a result. The blast wave has to expand. And then you say, well, what's the fastest that I can turn that material that it's been enriched and is interacting with interstellar medium into stars? So, and the answer is, well, I have to wait until this blast wave cools. Yeah? And once material cool, it can actually be turned into stars. And that's really a very strict limit as to how much material you need. And this is basically ultimately what's called the cooling mass. If I have a certain amount of energy put into an interstellar medium of this density with a given metallicity, what's the amount of material that I have to sweep before I cool? And then if you have the amount of material, of external material that you have to sweep, then you say, well, how much material I can distribute so that I can see the abundance variations that I get in stars. So this is a very simple argument, and therefore, based on the cooling mass, you can get basically what is the minimum amount of metals that I have to inject into the interstellar medium in order to produce those abundance variations that I see in stars. And the answer is actually striking. You have to produce, this is of course the Sneden star. In the Sneden star, it tells you that you at least have to produce 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per event in order to explain the high abundance of europium that we see in that star. Now, I put a line here, and this is the line, this is the amount of mass that you need to produce in supernova based on the rate, and I'll tell you why that's the case. But just basically, observations of stars immediately ruled out also standard core collapse, and that means that you really have to produce significantly more material per explosion. And then you say, well, how much material do I need to produce? And a number that you should keep in mind, so in the Milky Way has been forming about one sun per year for its entire history of the universe. It's an order of magnitude estimate. So every time you have a birthday, there's a new sun. That's more or less the scale that you should keep. Well, our process material is just 10 to the minus 7 solar masses per year. Yeah. So in order to produce the total amount of our process material in the Milky Way, I need a source to produce 10 to the minus 7 solar mass per year. And that's a very stringent constraint of your production rate. And of course, what ends up happening is, core collapse supernovae happen about once every century. So once every 10 to the minus 2. So that means that in order to get that rate, they had to produce 10 to the minus 5 solar masses. And that line that you saw there draw is 10 to the minus 5 solar masses, which is ruled out. Neutron star mergers, it's a little bit, the rate is a little bit more uncertain, but it's about something like 10 to the minus 5 of these events per year. That means that if you produce 10 to the minus 2 solar masses, you get the magical 10 to the minus 7. So 10 to the minus 2 multiplied by 10 to the minus 5, then you get these 10 to the minus 7. And that was basically before we had a lot of abundance observations of stars. These were the two competing models, and they give you a rate that it's about comparable. Now, you can multiply this rate by the age of the universe, which is about 10 to the 10 or so, 10 to the 11. And you get that in the Milky Way, there's about 1,000 to 10,000 solar masses of total R process. Yeah? So if you do a mass inventory of R process in the universe, you only get a few thousand solar masses of R process. And of course, 6% of that is gold, if you're very interested. So there's not a lot of gold in the Milky Way. OK, so this is just repeating myself, one every 100 years. And people thought that you can produce at least 10 to the minus 5 solar masses. This is, of course, much rarer, but we believe that we produce significantly more mass per event. This is just showing what I just illustrated, that type 2 supernova are ruled out. You have to produce, this is, I think, the 50% and the 90% distributions of the excess abundance that you need. And of course, it also depends on energy. If you have a very energetic explosion, it takes longer to cool, and therefore you have to produce more, like if you had a magnetar. But neutron star mergers sort of leave here, and we believe that that's sort of the conditions necessary to produce the R process. OK, so neutron star mergers. So how we can make the R process in this system? So what I'm going to show you here is the simplest and probably most robust element side for neutron star mergers, which are in the tidal tails. I'm showing. And I have to apologize to Will, a very old simulation, which is probably not very accurate, but that's what we did in my PhD in collaboration with Stefan Rosborg. And here, really, what I just want to illustrate is that you have two objects. In this case, they're a similar amount of mass. They become dynamically unstable. They get mass shredding in the outer Lagrangian points. And a fraction of, about 1% at most of a solar mass may be able to be ejected above the escape velocity. So what I'm going to show you is basically the trajectories of making the R process in these tails. Okay, so we're talking about, we're going to follow the thermodynamical evolution with the nuclear network of these tails.
Where the video paused and the colors changed, that was just a change of scale.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you know, this field has really exploded, and in fact, we're now getting into cases where the GR, full GR, is actually well understood, and now we're really focusing on much more in the microphysics. But in general, people agree that the mass ejection is between 5 times 10 to the minus 3 to 5 times 10 to the minus 2, and that the ejection velocity is between 0.3 and 0.1. And the way that you can think about it, that's the escape velocity at the outer Lagrangian points, which depends on the mass ratio, the equation of state, and so forth. But you know, that's, as an order of magnitude, something to keep in mind. And of course, you know, this is the range that if you now multiply by the LIGO rate inferred from one event, you get more or less this magical 10 to the minus 7 solar masses. Okay, so this is what everyone was waiting for. We're starting in the tidal tails. What you see here, it's the temperature and density as a function of time. Temperature in red, density in blue, and the heating rate is in black. The heating rate is basically the nuclear decay from these radioactive elements impinging back into the system, so increasing the entropy of the flow. Now, as I was telling Neil, this is at time equals zero. If I take a piece of neutron star material in the tidal tails, in nuclear statistical equilibrium, I have tons of neutrons, but I also have the nuclei. And you can see it here. So this is really convenient because I already have the targets in which these neutrons are going to capture. The problem in core collapse supernova is that in nuclear statistical equilibrium, I don't have those nuclei, and I have to make them. And I have to make them through triple alpha reactions to go all the way to oxygen, and that's actually a process that takes a lot of time. And that's one of the bottlenecks for the core collapse case. But here you don't. So what I'm showing you is the results of an R process network, which has neutron captures, photodissociations, alpha and beta decay, and fission reactions. Also, when you capture neutrons, you can also fission. Okay. So there you go. Neutron capture rate, I clearly see a stagnation in the first, second, and third peak. I go to very, very high nuclei, and then I basically beta decay back to stability, and then first peak, second peak, and third peak. Okay. So what you're saying is that I can try to change the initial conditions slightly between the relative peaks of those initial conditions and whatever, you know, thermodynamical pathway, I better converge to a case in which the ratio of these two peaks is actually relatively stable. And I can show you kind of the compilation of simulations from the majority of groups using different sort of formalisms, sort of converging to an abundance pattern that is relatively robust. And in this case, you can actually change the entropy, and it doesn't really matter very much because the initial two peaks in nuclear statistical equilibrium are very insensitive.
So before the decay, that red line to this.
You want to play it again?
Well, that red line's shape, I mean, should change from object to object, right? At that point right there before it decayed, right?
Yeah.
So therefore, then the pattern that produced then after decay, then should change.
So it's basically the timescale of decompression of nuclear matter, how fast these, you know, acceleration is. So that's a very critical. And the other thing that it is basically what is the electron fraction, which is the proton to neutron ratio, and the entropy. And those. And basically, what we do here, for example, is put 10,000 or so little tracers in these tails, and then see how different is the pattern that we converge, from place to place, and it's relatively stable. So one of the arguments that we think is that in this case, for example, and we'll talk a little bit about how you see these objects, that there's not a lot of abundance gradients within the tails. But that's another interesting sort of, which, for example, in supernova you have very steep gradients with velocity. Okay, so how much?
In the meanwhile, the density decreasing curve is expanding, and also the temperature is also decreasing. Is that important? I think that also.
It's very important because ultimately what we call this neutron decompression is exactly the fact that everything is decreasing, you just shut down the process. And at some point, if you actually looked, let's look at the heating rate is relatively high and then it just plummets, yeah? And both basically the density and the heating rate. So what this tells you once the heating rate plummets is that you're not producing any more new elements. And you're just basically, as you said, adiabatically cooling. And I'll show you what are the implications of that. And the key for us to see these transients is that as you expand, and I think here the time scales is already hours, but it's gonna go all the way to very late times, this nuclear heating is still heating up the material. And that's basically what makes it shine. Yeah? The fact that it's not pure adiabatic decompression, you know, cooling, but that the heating rate is basically keeping the entropy of this material. And then when it becomes transparent, you see it.
So this must be depending on the model of the dynamics and also depending on the initial condition of the neutron merger.
Yeah,
so
we can talk a lot about if you want at the end of the talk and something that will, you know, it's very interested in is like the reason why I'm showing you the tidal tails is also because in the tidal tails you don't get a lot of neutrino absorption from the remnant, but also the neutrino capture changes the nucleosynthesis. Whether or not the wind, I mean, here we have a very clear kinematic or dynamical pattern of the tails. But of course, if you're making a wind, you know, through neutrino interactions or blowing it, everything that you're talking about, you know, how quickly you accelerate it matters, you know, how fast, what is the energy and all of that. So what we're basically finding is that in more complex environments, it's much more difficult to get that robustness. Maybe it's because we are not doing it correctly, but particularly what the observation is telling you is that you better get the abundance pattern robust. So yeah, so there's certainly lots of uncertainties. And you know, I think two people in this audience will argue with me that the total amount of material that we see, you cannot produce in the tidal tails.
Can I ask, well, in that reaction that we're here, just a simulated reaction, of course, is that what fraction of the kind of cross-sections and rates in there are measured in what, are they all measured rates, or are a lot of them modeled rates?
Okay, so this is the R process abundance pattern. This black line, which I on purpose didn't show, shows anything above the black line, we have experimental evidence for it. Everything that is below the black line relies on models.
And is it, do you know to what extent do people believe those models, or how accurate are they thought to be here?
To the extent that the pattern is so robust, I think it's more like, well, if you're producing the robustness of the of those models, people give credence to some of this, but we can talk more offline. But yes, those things do lead to small variations, but remember that the uncertainties in the determination of the abundance patterns are still not perfect. So you have some wiggle room within the abundance pattern, within the errors that we measured.
Yeah, I'm just curious. About the order of logic, are the models calibrated independently and then they predict the right patterns, or is it part of one of the calibrations for those models that they get the right R process ratio?
The nuclear models are not calibrated to give you the pattern.
Oh, so they can kind of independently predict the right R process.
Yeah, that's the key. Okay, so let's look at my favorite peak, which is 5% of the R process mass, which is gold. So how much gold one of these systems produce? Well, it produces about a Jupiter mass of gold, just to give you an order of magnitude estimate. So of course, you know, Jupiter mass is 10 to the 30 grams. Gold is about $10 per gram, so it's about 10 to the 31 dollars, one of these events. If that's not impressive, you know, this is also the amount of gold stored in about a million of stars. So then you immediately start saying, oh, well, one of these events can supply with significant amount of our process to the star. So it's really a rare event, but it produces a lot of mass. And this is going to become key for the last part of my talk, if I get to it. Okay, so what we know is that these systems undergo a long secular evolution in which they're driven by gravitational waves for hundreds of mega years to giga years. Very, very quickly, in a few milliseconds, they become dynamically unstable. And at least I'm going to focus on the unbound debris. This material is basically ejected. very, very quickly in the, you know, before a beta decay timescale, you produce the R process. And really what matters to try to understand the light curve is how much mass of R process you made and what its velocity distribution, just broadly speaking. Then this material is expanding, but there's expansion and nuclear heating of the flow, and you're keeping the entropy high. And then after a few days, the you know, the system becomes optically thin, the electrons scattering, the photons can escape, and then you see it in a light curve. So the photosphere of these, it's about few AU, and if you're not familiar, it's 10 to 13 centimeters. That's more or less the characteristic scale. So about a few days, these objects become optically thin. So how do we do these calculations? Well, this is what it's called the Arnett model. So you have basically a radiation-dominated free-streaming material that, as we heard before, it's basically adiabatically cooling because it's expanding. Radiation is trapped, so this is the diffusion term. And then you have this heating term. And that's the heating that comes from the R process decay. And this is one of the things that Luke Roberts did for his PhD thesis. He calculated what is the energy deposition as a function of time and showed that it was actually a power law, similar to what Paczynski, without doing any calculations, predicted. Paczynski said, well, there's so many nuclei that are giving you decay that the distribution should be a power law. And this is basically what we see. This is the contribution of one single element to the entire decay. And as you can see, the addition of all the contributions gives you something that it's a power. So if you have the heating rate, we can actually make calculations of how the light curve looks like. And then, you know, very simply, what we find is let's, for example, change the mass and the velocity. So if you change the mass, what do you do? Well, you basically increase the heating rate, so the light curve will tend to be a little bit brighter. But since you increase the mass, the optical depth increases, so the time scale in which you become optically thin basically moves to longer time scales. So if you increase the mass, you move in this direction, you get a light curve that is basically significantly brighter, but longer lived. And velocity basically increases in this direction. When you increase the velocity, you move to this direction because you become optically thin much faster. But yet your nuclear energy deposition stays the same. So these were sort of the type of models that very simply we run. And one of the biggest uncertainties in this field is to try to calculate what the opacity of the material is. Yeah, and that's actually, as I will show you, is one of the largest uncertainties that we have. We don't know the atomic structure of these nuclei. You know, they have hundreds of thousands, some of them millions of lines, and we don't know the oscillation strength and the positions of all of these lines. So we cannot basically integrate and tell you what the average mean opacity of this material is. And this was basically assuming an iron opacity, which we now know is wrong. The opacity has to be significantly higher because these atomic nuclei have a lot of atomic complexity, and I'll show you that in a second. Okay, so this is very happy day for a lot of us. This is, of course, the detection of the neutron star merger by LIGO in 2017. As we were talking at lunchtime, the position uncertainty in this case, because Virgo did not detect it, was, you know, much better. So we can actually attempt to look for an optical counterpart in this error box. And we were part of these 1 meter, two hemisphere collaboration. So we have a 1 meter telescope in Lick Observatory in Northern California, and there's the Swope telescope in Chile. They're both 1 meters. And of course, you don't really know where in the skies it's gonna happen. So we said, you know, we cover our bases and we have one in each hemisphere. So this is a group that is led by my colleague, Ryan Foley. I'm the oldest person in this picture, but there's lots of young people. Here we have both Charlie and David, which were basically essential to make the discovery. And I'll tell you a little bit about the discovery and how it took place. So just to give you a feeling, we were competing with telescopes like DDCAM that were significantly bigger. So they have 16 times the light collecting power and 12 times the field of view. And I think we got lucky. We had the right strategy. So let me give you a feeling. So this is the error. This is basically the field of view in the south. This is the error circle. And we had to wait about 10 hours for the sun to set in Chile in order to start looking for these events. So if there would be a 1 meter telescope in Africa, they would have detected these before. So the strategy that we did is, well, we cannot compete with very large telescopes that are just sweeping the entire error box. So what we do is we, as if you were at Neil's talk this morning, we think that these systems are associated with galaxies. We know the distance to the source. We know the majority of galaxies within that volume. And we basically try to maximize an algorithm that in a single pointing, we get as many galaxies as possible. And then we rank them based on stellar mass, because we think that stellar mass is a good tracer. So here is 46 minutes after sunset, 10 hours after the trigger, our team started looking. All of those are galaxies within the pointings. And you try to maximize the number of galaxies. Until about 63 minutes, there it was. So we were the first team that saw the light from this object. David, thanks to building this algorithm, beat these very large telescopes and basically discovered the source. Let me show you how it looks. This is the SWOP supernova survey. That's the number 17A. The supernova hasn't even started, so this is the first source that the survey detected. That's why A. The system, the object was very blue to begin with and then became very red. And one of the theoretical predictions that we made is that the opacity of this material was be so high in the blue that photons could only escape into the red, just because if you think about it, there were so many lines that you will be optically thick. Just checking the time. So the simplest thing that you can do is you can take the bolometric light curve and basically do a calorimetry analysis. So this is basically the radioactive that you saw. This is the energy injection rate predicted by these nuclear networks. This is the bolometric luminosity. So just by looking at the heating rate, you immediately get a minimum mass of about 0.02 solar masses. That's what you need to, that's what you need to do in order to predict just how much light was produced. And of course, that's a minimum estimate because there's a thermalization uncertainty of how much of that radioactive energy, actually escaped from the remnant or actually was effectively trapped and thermalized. But it's sort of nice that, this produces predictions that are very, very similar to what we have. So the first argument that people think that we are seeing our processed material being produced is because we know the radioactive energy decay as a function of time. So that's the first clue. The second clue was the argument that if you actually produce, so this is the first peak, which we call the blue peak, and we call the blue peak because the number of lines and the oscillation strengths of these elements are not very high. So we think that you will become optically thin still in the blue. So the opacity is not very large. And this is what usually people refer to as the red kilonova. And the problem is that the lanthanides, which live around here, have so much atomic complexity. So imagine also these lines are broadened by 0.1c of velocity. So basically, you have an ocean of opacity, and the photons can only escape in the red. So the fact, as you can see here, this is our blue and our red component, the fact that we saw a significant decrease in the blue led people to believe that, in fact, we have indeed produced second and third peak elements in this particular case because the object got extremely red. So the two-component model is that you had initially a blue component, and then a red component came. So that's the simplest. And of course, these are one-dimensional models and don't take into account the sort of radiation transport in 3D effects that you may have. So this is the lessons learned from the LIGO event. So the LIGO event gives you that there's about 25 mergers per mega year. Again, that's the 10 to the minus 5 per galaxy per year. The estimates show that this event show an average of total R process mass of about 0.06 mass ejected in the event. And the factor of 3 from what I show you has to do with the thermalization. And then if you basically take this rate and multiply by the mass per event, you get that over the galactic history, you get about 10,000 solar masses of our process, which is more or less the mass inventory that we have in the Milky Way.
And so do you have an estimate of how to split up that 6% of the solar mass into these?
No. I mean, we do, but in the two model component, they're almost equal. We can talk a little bit more about what the abundance patterns that we see in stars constrain in terms of whether or not you can have first and second and third peak independently. You cannot just get a lot of one versus a little of the other because the observations do constrain that ratio. But now a lot of the work is in trying to understand the details of how this source produced that much.
And the limits on production from supernovae is that it's less than 10% or less than 1% of the galactic.
So the majority of typical supernova models produce 10 to the minus 5 solar mass per event. Models that involve a magnetar trying to get that estimate to about 10 to the minus 3. So they're still struggling to get this much mass. At all. In the supernova case, it's much more difficult to do just because your YE or the electron fraction is not as high. Okay, so something that it's interesting is where this event took place in the galaxy, which of course, as you know, allows to measure the redshift. They happen relatively far away from the galaxy. These objects, neutron star mergers, as we see in our own Milky Way, have a center of mass velocity that moves them relatively far away from their place of birth. So one of the arguments that people make is, okay, we have convincing evidence that in that galaxy, which is relatively close to us, very close to solar metallicity, our process happened. And the question is, can these systems have been operating since the early universe? And one of the big debates is that it takes time for these systems to merge. And I'm going to argue why. Well, because you have to make basically two neutron stars that are relatively close to each other. So if you ask, I take two neutron stars, how close they have to be for them to merge by the emission of gravitational waves, and the answer is a few stellar radii. And then you say, well, that doesn't make sense, because of course, their progenitors were more extended. So how that? And the way that we get around is we call this common envelope evolution. So you form one neutron star, then you have another star. The star evolves through the Rege-Ion phase and engulfs the neutron star. The neutron star then spirals in by dynamical friction. That dynamical friction ejects the envelope, and then you're left with a helium core and a neutron star, and then the helium core turns into another neutron star, and then on average, you have to wait between 100 mega years to 10 giga years for this system to merge. So the bottleneck is how quickly you get. Whale, for example, can make them dynamically, and dynamically, you know, they will merge much faster. They don't have as much of a time delay. Now, if you think, well, this doesn't make any sense, well, at least the observations of double neutron stars in the Milky Way, which are shown here, have delays between 100 mega years to 10 giga years, telling you that they have to have experienced a common envelope. So then people started arguing, well, even with 100 mega year delay, can I actually enrich low metallicity stars? Yeah, is it too late in the stage of the universe before I produce too much iron? Is 100 mega years the time scale that people worry? And the answer is, 30 years ago, people thought this is the bottleneck of making the R process in the early universe. By 100 mega years, the universe gets relatively metal rich. And I will dispute that claim, showing you some simulations.
Is that in a lower range, like secure? And, why is it 100 and not like 1 mega year?
Because of the size of the helium core. So something that you can do, but then is, for example, that when the helium core collapses and produces a neutron star, that the neutron star is sent into the direction of the companion and then basically relatively quickly merge at high eccentricity. But of course, just by solid angle arguments, that channel is small. But some people claim that that channel may be enough to produce a fast channel of our process. Okay, so.
To make sure I understand the argument you just made for the so you're saying 30 years ago people thought they had evidence for our process enrichment prior to 100 years?
People use very, very naive models of chemical enrichment in the early universe to claim that neutron star mergers were not able to enrich the Milky Way after 100 mega years. But there was, I mean, the evidence is this, no? The evidence is that we see stars with iron abundance of about -3 that are already enriched with europium. Now, we have proven by the detection of these gravitational waves that we can enrich with europium here. The question is, can we enrich these stars? And basically, that's the last part of my talk. I'm going to show you a simulation that does that effectively. But I'm running a little bit of time. So I'm going to give you just a simple analogy that I really like, which is, you know, if you have type 2s, so type 2s happen very often, like once per century across the Milky Way. So if they were enriching stars with our process, you know, the analogy is that they will be like a chocolate cookie with a very thin layer, and the chocolate is well spread out and, you know, everywhere. But if you have neutron star mergers, they happen rare and put a lot of chocolate, so they're more like chocolate chip cookies. Yeah? So if you happen to be born with material that was enriched by a neutron star merger, you will have a lot of europium, but if you're far away from it, you won't. And you're,
well, star formation is clustered, right? I mean, so supernovae might also be spatially clustered.
In addition, neutron star mergers happen far away from the cold gas, so that material has to come back, cool, and form stars. And that's basically what we did in the simulation. Okay, so just quickly, I won't go into the details of the simulation, but we just tell you that, as Neil pointed out, type 2 traces the star formation, and we just basically assume that mergers trace the stellar mass. So they're basically injected randomly with a probability distribution that is the stellar mass in the simulation. So what you see here is the formation of a Milky Way-like galaxy. What you're seeing here is the gas. So the gas is in gray, and then the purple component is the cold gas, the gas that is actually able to cool and therefore collapse. And then in pink is the stellar light. So that's the new star formation. So you can think of it, the neutron star mergers are happening around here. They're enriching this material is coming back and forming new stars. And initially, as you pointed out, there's not a very clear disk, and star formation is happening in many, many directions. And of course, the Milky Way is a relatively boring galaxy, one of the galaxies that today hasn't experienced a major merger, but as you know, we're gonna experience a major merger relatively soon, cosmologically.
Is enough mixing to explain to?
Okay, so I won't tell you a little bit about the rates, but I'll just gonna end my talk with this plot, and I'll take a little bit of time. So astronomers use the following argument, and which we call closed box model of chemical evolution. So they assume that the Milky Way is a box, that the metals are mixed instantaneously. And basically, if you know the rate of metal production, then you can calculate what the average metallicity of the Milky Way is as a function of time. And that is basically shown, you know, we run a model that is very similar to the Matteucci model with 100 mega-year time delay. And this is the average metallicity in that box, which means that by the time 100 mega-years happen, there's basically the iron abundance in the box was already -1.5, which means that there's no way that I can produce any stars at lower metallicity. So you say, well, does that make sense? So I take, in our simulation, the average metallicity of the coal gas, and it's in blue. And not surprisingly, it follows the closed box model relatively effectively. But then the argument is the stars that we're making are in green. And what this tells you is that the mixing time scale of the Milky Way is relatively slow. And if you think about it, mixing happens, you know, subsonically, and a sound wave takes about 1 giga-year to cross across the Milky Way. So what that tells you is that the average abundance is really not representative of the abundance distribution across the Milky Way. It's extremely patchy. Yeah, and then you have basically multiple regions in which you can actually have low metallicity. Now, just to make a point here, we have to use a diffusion coefficient for the metal mixing in this particular simulation. And what we did is we basically chose the magnesium variations that we saw, make sure that the diffusion coefficient of type 2 gives us the magnesium distribution, then use the same diffusion coefficient for the neutron star mergers, and we naturally were able to explain the observations. But I think there's lots of things to be learned in the early universe about how effectively these metals mix and understanding turbulent mixing in the early universe. But what I will argue is that early on in the history of the Milky Way, it's incorrect to use these average, you know, closed box models, which at this case, you know, make no sense. So there's still a significant amount of debate, but theoretically, you know, models are showing that the average that we see in europium variations, which are large, are reproduced by the simulations. And this argument of the chocolate chip cookie is not a crazy model in which, you know, this Sneden star was probably, you know, born very, very close to one of these neutron star mergers, very close to the chocolate chip cookie, and it got a lot of europium, while some of these stars, you know, were not able to be enriched that effectively. This is just to illustrate that with the illustrious simulation, Jill Neyman has now done not one Milky Way, but 1,000 Milky Way-likes using different merger trees, and we converge on the same. And she has this kind of very cute graph in which it shows the more metal-enriched stars in the simulations are, of course, gold-enriched. And you can see there are few. And you know what we now try to understand is really the distribution and the fraction of stars that are enriched. And of course, hopefully with Gaia, we can have kinematics of these stars and see if they're different. OK, so I will conclude here. You know, we hope that I convince you that these systems are, you know, a site of our process nucleosynthesis, that they seem to produce a robust nuclear pathway, at least in the tidal tails. There's some debate as to whether the tidal tails can do the whole story or not, and that they are in fact consistent with chemical evolution and could in principle be the main provider of our process in the universe. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Last year, I remember Daniel Siegel wrote a paper on this CRAPSAT model. It seems he's trying to argue that the CRAPSAT model actually can produce more evidence than neutron star mergers. Can you comment on that?
I think that model is ruled out by the observations for the following reason, which is, I mean, there's significant level of uncertainty of what happens to the star before it collapses and what happens to the envelope. But in the general standard formalism of the collapsar model, there's significant, I mean, as you know, the collapsar model is used to explain long gamma ray bursts that have huge amount of nucleosynthetic yields like iron and other alpha elements. So in that particular case, you will have very strong correlations between these alpha elements and europium. So if both were basically made by the same source, there will be a strong correlation, which you don't see in the data, which you just see basically no correlation whatsoever. So what I will argue is if they want that model to work, so if you want a model that follows the star formation, which I'm not opposed to, that produces our process, the only thing that you have to do is detach it to the chemical enrichment of alpha elements. And that's very difficult to do in those models. So observationally, I agree that at least within the conditions that they think, the initial conditions of the disk, I mean, the argument is that the disk conditions are very similar to neutron star merger conditions. But there's that argument sort of neglects everything that had happened before you collapse to a black hole and the fact that you have a star to begin with. And then what are the nucleosynthesis outputs of that? If you didn't produce any jet, but it's kind of hard to, you know, for me, if you actually produce an accretion disk, you have huge amount of feedback, and you're actually going to send a blast wave into the star that is going to be very energetic and produce a significant amount of alpha elements. So that would be my complaint on that particular model. And any model that involves a supernova, you have to basically be able to detach the chemical evolution of these alpha elements. And in particularly in the collapsar, it's even worse because it produces tons and tons of iron. Like 90 ABW, which is sort of standard collapsar, you know, the model was basically made to explain that event. It produced 0.5 solar masses of nickel, which is, you know, a huge amount of iron, and then you will see a very strong iron correlation. So, I mean, I feel in some ways that there's lots of things that we're trying to do in different environments. You know, like, you know, Will and Luis will argue that there's no way that the tidal tails can produce that much mass. So that means that you have to wait until the merger, you have to wait until the hot remnant, and you have to wait maybe until the collapse of the black hole. And under those circumstances, the neutrino deposition is not well understood. And so far, I would say that there is no group that consistently has gotten a pattern that is robust between the second and third peak. In fact, most of those models seem to produce a lot of first peak, a little second peak, and no third peak. And that's certainly ruled out by the robustness of the R process pattern. So we're trying hard to basically, we're writing this paper and we just say, this is what we know from stars. And these are sort of the constraints in any model that you have to do. Those are the constraints that you cannot violate. But I think the jury is still out, and I think the field is just starting thinking about this in much more detail. And remember that full radiation transport of neutrinos hasn't really been done effectively in neutron star mergers. And it has been done in the supernova case.
When you said about, in response to Juan's question, it's that for long GRBs, you don't see a strong correlation between the S process and the R process abundances.
S process doesn't happen in these explosive environments. We think S process happens in AGB stars, and that alpha elements.
What are alpha elements?
Oh, helium, carbon, oxygen, iron, all those peaks that you see in abundance. I mean, anything that goes into the alpha burning network, which basically gives the stability to stars. So helium, carbon, oxygen. Yeah, those are all alpha elements. So magnesium, iron, all the iron peak elements. In the problem, for example, in the collapsar, is that you produce so much iron within your blast wave that you're significantly more dominant in iron than the external medium, and then you really want to get a huge europium to iron abundance excess, and that becomes a little bit more complicated. So I think something that it's actually, just to give you a feeling, if you haven't thought about this, which is actually a little bit striking, is if you ask, I take, even in my most optimistic model, and I start basically mixing, diluting those elements as I mix further and further with more gas, the ratio of my europium to iron or alpha starts to decrease. And the standard kind of estimate for a mixing mass, which is how much material one event mixes, is about 10 to the 5 solar masses. So it's not a lot, no? So that means that, especially in the early universe, the majority of these low metallicity stars were enriched by one event. And that's what makes it so attractive, that you can just use the abundance pattern and not worry that there were multiple events enriching that. And that's what I'm saying, like whatever, if you propose a model, whatever you see in the abundance pattern of materials that are ejected should be imprinted in the stars, which is interesting.
So regarding this question of trying to get the large amount of ejecta from the neutron star merger, either looking at the tidal tails, maybe there's some underestimates there versus like trying to get the radiation back with the merger stuff. But do you have a feeling on which thing is more trying to around? Would it count more for this?
Well, I mean, I am worried, as you are, that this much amount of mass, it's hard to. I mean, even in the Newtonian simulation, it's hard to get that much material ejected. So I feel like we still need to study the nucleosynthetic component. I mean, there's another argument that I feel like this event had a gamma ray burst, and I'm extremely biased that you cannot produce a gamma ray burst until you collapse to a black hole. Just because the neutrino-driven wind is throwing so much material that the pollution, trying to get a Lorentz factor of 10 in an environment that is so polluted with baryons is very, very difficult to get this high entropy. So you have to wait until you got a much cleaner environment. And if that's the case, I kind of like more the neutron, the accretion disk kind of model. But there's many more knobs in that case. Because you get also a broad range of nucleosynthetic yields depending on the radius of the disk. But I think it's given us a lot to think about. And hopefully once we get more than one event,
any other questions?
Thank you.